like to thank Health Administration for having me speak this morning. We have kind of got organizational views on process improvement, and so I'm kind of going to bring us up to the system level now. And I'm going to be talking about actually physician workforce data as a strategic issue in access to healthcare in the U.S. and at the state level. And specifically, we're going to be examining a study that I performed looking at physician response to a licensure survey in Indiana. I'd like to begin by saying I have no financial relationships to disclose on this project or any of the information I will be sharing today. Just briefly to discuss the objectives of my talk this morning, I'd like to discuss with you the value of physician workforce data. You could substitute the word physician for health workforce because this data is critical across our health professions in the U.S. I will also describe how non-response bias, which is that people who choose not to respond to surveys are different than those that do, is a recognized threat to our current workforce data quality. And I'm going to provide some rationale and background for the study that we performed in Indiana and then present findings and implications for future research. I'd like to begin by having us consider the U.S. healthcare workforce and the physician workforce. These individuals are the intersection of medical science, of health service delivery, and of healthcare access in the U.S. They are critical. They are the critical linkage, and they are the point of contact for patients in the healthcare system. So it is crucial that we understand who, what, when, where, and why about our physician workforce. And what do I mean by that? We need to know who are our physicians, what are their demographics. We need to know what specialties they practice. For physicians, there's a myriad of specialties and subspecialties that physicians can practice in. What are they practicing? Do they practice different specialties at different locations? In addition, how many hours are they in practice? And how many hours are they in direct patient care? We all may be familiar with the enormous paperwork that is required of healthcare providers. But how many hours are they actually touching patients in direct care with patients versus the time that they're working on administrative processes? Where are they practicing? And by where, I mean what geography, what location. What location are they practicing? Do they have multiple practices? And how many hours are they contributing to direct patient care at all of the practices that they are practicing at? These questions are answered with physician workforce data. These data help us to understand our supply. They help us to identify shortage, surplus at a state, at a local, at a national level. And by shortage and surplus, that could be at a population level. So, for example, individuals with state Medicaid insurance programs, they may live in a geography with a surplus of physicians, but in reality, very few physicians may be accepting their insurance. So, high-quality data on our workforce is critical. These data are used by health systems, by local health departments for community needs assessments. And in addition, these data are critical to informing pertinent policy decisions and allocation of resources. Our health center program here in the U.S., the Federally Qualified Health Center Program, it is dependent upon federal designations of medical underservice that requires physician workforce data as part of the calculation for shortage designation. In addition, workforce recruitment and retention, whether it's state programs or federal programs, such as the National Health Service Corps, these data are critical for those, and academic programs and initiatives. How many physicians do we need? What kind? What kind of demographics should we be recruiting into our medical schools to ensure access that's culturally sensitive for all of our individuals that we serve? So obviously, physician workforce data, health workforce data, is a critical issue. It's important. What is the state of health workforce data and physician data in the U.S.? Unfortunately, it is fragmented and inconsistent, although it is extensive. A myriad of stakeholders are collecting data from physicians, including demographic and practice characteristics, from the federal all the way down to the local level, and in addition, researchers. I've listed here a number of agencies or sources of data on the physician workforce, including the federal government, for those of you that are familiar with HRSA, the Area Resource File has data on the physician workforce. Our census collects data on the physician workforce and other health workforce members, and of course the Bureau of Labor Statistics. At the state level, our licensing boards gather and maintain these data during licensure proceedings, and of course our state primary care offices, those that actually go after our shortage designations, they require these type of data and collect these data frequently. Professional organizations like the American Medical Association collect and maintain data for their physician master files, and researchers are continuously surveying physicians for their perspectives and different research studies that they're working on. So the limitation is various collection methods are used. The survey tools don't define questions the same, meaning that we can't link data between sources. So unfortunately, we have a lot of data on the workforce, but we have no way of getting a comprehensive, complete, high-resolution picture. In addition, just as evidence that health workforce data is critical here in the U.S., there were specific provisions in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act for health workforce assessment and specifically the data collection and management of health workforce data. Title V was entitled the Healthcare Workforce, and under Section 5103, Healthcare Workforce Assessment, there was the establishment and expansion of a National Center for Health Workforce Analysis. One of the main activities of this center is the development of tools and the creation of national minimum data sets for the health professions. And these tools are going to be used to standardize the collection methods. But the minimum data sets will be generated from data that's aggregated at the state level. So our states will collect these data using the minimum data set tool, and then it will be sent to the National Center for Health Workforce Analysis and generated into national minimum data sets for us to get a national picture of our workforce. The quality of our national level data is directly dependent upon our states, the quality of their data that they have. And in Indiana, we have been looking at our physician workforce data in addition to our dental data, our data on dentists and other health professions. And so I'd just like to share with you our sources of data. So Indiana currently does have a survey of physicians that is administered in conjunction with licensure proceedings. So on the biennial licensure renewal process, physicians have the opportunity to complete an elective survey. It is elective, however, it is actually interwoven into the process of renewing your license. And so any physician who completes their renewal electronically has access to this survey. Understanding that this was an issue, 2 years ago, Indiana began to work to centralize our health workforce data through a project called the Indiana Health Workforce Database Project. The Indiana Statewide Physician Database was the key and the first database that we generated. We used data from previous licensure surveys, but we also linked it to data on Medicaid from our Medicaid office, on claims counts, utilization data, and actual practice locations that were associated with the Office of Medicaid. The data from the statewide physician database are currently used by our primary care office in Indiana for the designation activities. It's used by healthcare organizations and associations that are working on needs assessments. In addition, researchers are accessing these data, and we have put out a number of policy briefs looking at key workforce issues that have been put together for stakeholders and legislators that are in decision-making capacities. When we first examined our physician licensure survey, we realized that non-responders really were a threat to understanding whether or not we had quality information. And we immediately went to the literature to find out, well, what is the standard non-response rate in surveys of physicians? There is survey research is a whole body in science. But looking specifically at physicians, what are the standard response rates? And in those studies, did they identify differences between responders and non-responders? Because that's critical. And so in the research, we identified that the average response rate is somewhere between 50 and 80% in physician studies. Very few studies have access to information on non-responders, just by virtue of they did not respond with any of their information. However, some studies did have access, and most of those studies were administered by professional organizations or associations that maintained member information. And one study did identify that non-responder physicians did differ in certain demographic characteristics from those physicians that responded. So we asked the question, what is the impact of non-response in a licensure survey, in a survey that's administered by a state specifically to understand gaps in access related to workforce? And are the physicians that would respond to this, are they similar to their colleagues that do not respond? And then if we have response bias, is it the same that is found in the literature? So the current study, we basically assessed a licensure survey from Indiana from 2011 to assess these factors and determine whether the data that we had was generalizable, whether the characteristics of responders and non-responders were similar. We did a cross-sectional study using the 2011 Indiana Physician Licensure Survey. We had over 13,000 physicians included in the data. The response rate for our survey, which was defined as complete response to all questions required for designation activities. So all of the different practice information, the geography, the specific locations, and the FTE, full-time equivalency, or hours in direct patient care per office, per location. That's what we were interested in. They had to answer all of those questions to be considered a responder. We linked that data to the Indiana statewide physician database, which had a large amount of information on all physicians, including the non-responders, and were able to tap into data on the non-responders that way. When we were examining characteristics based on what we found in the literature, we examined age, sex, race as demographic characteristics, and then the practice characteristics of interest. We looked at the hours in direct patient care, practice geography, and we only included one practice location, so the primary principal practice location, the geography of that, whether it was urban or rural, and then we looked at their state Medicaid participation and acceptance. Those were looked at separately, and they are important, and I'd like to note that physicians are asked to respond in the survey, do you currently accept Indiana Medicaid? Well, accepting Indiana Medicaid is very different than participating in Indiana Medicaid, because you may accept it, but in a fiscal year you may not see one patient on Indiana Medicaid even though you accept it. So fortunately, the statewide physician database linked via license number unique claims counts with Indiana Medicaid to a physician's data. So we were able to actually examine the difference between actual participation and responsive acceptance, self-reported responsive acceptance. So the results of just doing some analysis, and these tables, I realize they're small, but they're going to be made available later, and they are in the manuscript, so I wanted to put them here. This table is basically showing the difference in response rate by characteristic. And so this is specifically the demographic characteristics, and we did identify some differences in these characteristics, differences in response. Older physicians were slightly less likely to respond than were younger, and interesting, minority physicians were less likely to respond as well. And we're going to, in a few moments, I'm going to show you the multivariable analysis that we did, and minority physician non-response continued to be significant even when controlling for different factors. This is important because we're working to diversify our workforce. So we need to know currently where are our minorities practicing, where are they not, so that we can recruit into those areas. So capturing the response of our minority providers is critical. Looking at the practice characteristics and response rates, physicians who worked part-time as defined by less than 30 hours, and they were less likely to be respondents, as were specialist physicians. Now, the way that we define this, we grouped physicians into three categories. They were either primary care, using HRSA's definition of primary care, or they were psychiatry. And the reason that we had those two groups is you can receive a designation for primary care shortages, and you can also receive a designation for mental health shortages based on your psychiatry capacity in communities. And so specialists that were not primary care and not psychiatry were less likely to respond than were the psychiatrists and the primary care physicians. Urban practicing physicians were less likely to be respondents. And in addition, not surprisingly, physicians that did not accept, did not report accepting, and did not participate were less likely to respond, which is not surprising. So these are results of the logistic regression. We use stepwise selection. And as you can see, most of the variables that were significant when we were just observing the characteristics associated with response continued to be significant. Age was significant, so older still had a lower response rate than younger physicians. Part-time physicians were still less likely to respond than full-time, and the minority physicians were still less likely to respond. Medicaid as well. Now, in the final model, we only included the self-reported measure for Medicaid acceptance, and that was due to some limitations with the data that we had on the claims, and we felt more confident about this for inclusion in the model. Geography, interestingly enough, fell off once you controlled for all of those variables. So we had some interaction between the race variable and other variables, and so geography did not remain in the model. So after we found our variables, our characteristics of physicians that were associated with non-response, we wanted to compare that back to what did the literature report. And so a meta-analysis that examines, and there's a link to it, you'll see the footnote if you're interested and you see the slides later. It examined 50 surveys of physicians, but these were not state-level surveys. They were surveys that were done for research, but they did collect demographic and practice information. We compared our results to theirs. And the response rate in our survey was actually higher, although only by less than 10%. Age was significant in both. In both the meta-analysis and our findings, older physicians were less likely to respond, and there are a number of factors that could be driving that. Now, we did not find any difference by gender. Males and females answered had virtually the same response rate in the survey in Indiana, the licensure survey, but in the meta-analysis, females were less likely to respond than males. Race was not observed in theirs, and then the other difference was in practice geography. The meta-analysis found no differences by urban or rural geography, and in the bivariate, we did find an association. So I would like to say, though, that there are some limitations to our study. It would be great if I could tell you that in your state, you can use these findings and assume that your respondents are different than your non-respondents, but this only represents an analysis of one state licensure survey. So in order to generalize findings, we would have to replicate it with other states or do a nationally representative sample. In addition, we have some validity issues. There are a number of physicians that completed their license renewal using the paper renewal process. So they actually manually filled out their paperwork and mailed it in. The only physicians that had access to the survey were those that completed their survey through the web-based process. Now, I am happy to say that in the next licensure cycle, all health professionals are required to complete it online. So we will have 100% contact with the survey in the future. And we had contact with, I believe it was over 70% of physicians actually did use the web-based renewal process. But in the future, we'll actually even have a larger group that will represent the entire population. So just to kind of bring us back and summarize what we've discussed, because I know I just threw a lot at you. High-quality data on the physician workforce, and you could substitute mental health workforce, dental health workforce. It is a crucial issue at many levels of government. It's an issue for access. It's an issue for public health. States, licensing boards, and licensing agencies are strategically positioned to be able to gather these data when they have a captive audience during licensure proceedings. But in order to ensure that high-quality data is collected, licensing policies and survey policies have to be aligned to enhance response rates. And what do I mean by that? Well, currently, our survey is elective. So physicians can elect to complete or not complete the survey. So moving towards policies to either incentivize or require the reporting of certain key data that are necessary for needs assessments would be one way to enhance the data that we can collect. For future directions, the findings of this study, as I said, the generalizability is unknown. So it should be replicated with other state licensure data sets and surveys. And possibly on a nationally representative sample. If findings of a larger sample that's representative are consistent with our findings, then the model used in this analysis may be used to generate weightings for those non-respondents, that if we cannot collect data from them, we may be able to actually impute what do those non-respondents look like and what do we need to go after. So I would like to thank the Indiana State Health Department Primary Care Office for working with us on the statewide physician database project. I'd also like to thank the Bowen Research Center at Indiana University School of Medicine for their work on this. So, thank you so much.
Reducing no-show rates in a community-based clinic.
Okay. Elisa?
Improving access to residential psychiatric care.
Okay. And
physician workforce data is a strategic issue.
Okay. Now we're open for a question. I would like to start by asking Monica, you talked about the escort. Would you like to describe that service as to how that went about? Because you did find that using the escort, people didn't come in.
So it's an access to care program, and they are case managers and patient navigators. And so they do intensive outreach either by telephone encounters or letters, but most of our clients don't have a steady address or consistent phone number. We have a fairly high homeless population that we serve in our primary care clinics. So they're actually going out in the field to locations that they know that clients may be. So sort of either other programs that they know they're involved in, it could just be sort of neighborhood hangouts. And so they are out in the city kind of looking for folks. And then when they find them, they are either trying to arrange a time with them, or what seems to be most effective is if they can then and there walk them to the clinic and use a walk-in slot.
Who are these escorts? Are they like aides? Are they part-time people?
They're full-time social work staff, so they're full-time case managers.
And what's the caseload?
The caseload's high. I mean, so for access to care, they have, I want to say, between 30 to 50.
For every one FTE has 30 to 50?
Correct.
They can manage all of that.
Well, so mean, it's, you know, for example, our housing case managers have a smaller caseload, but they have more consistent encounters with their clients, so they sort of have monthly, a minimum of certain contacts a month, whereas the patient navigators, it's sort of more fluid, so they may have 50 clients, but one of those, it might just have been one phone call with them that month. So they're not all, the intensity of sort of the work with each one varies. Our caseloads are lower when it's sort of, this is your assigned caseload and you're going to have a monthly home visit with them and two monthly office visits. So then it's a little bit lower. But because they're sort of, and again, they're in the field, so if they capture more than one client, that's considered, that client might be part of their caseload that month, even though it was just one encounter when they were with another client, they happened to see this other person.
Is there any issues in terms of the escort going out to the blind person? Accompanied by somebody else, or they just go and hope things work out?
Yeah, there. I mean, a lot of our case management staff is field based, so they're out in the community. They are, you know, our housing case managers do home visits, so we're in people's homes, we're out in the streets, and there are no safety issues as of yet. Hard. I would say the main issue that everybody sort of thinks is the elephant in the room is substance use. And so sometimes, you know, when you engage with a client, the first step may not be taking them to their primary care visit. It may be taking care of other needs of theirs first, especially around patient retention, right? So it's one thing coming to one visit, but to actually have somebody engage in their medical care when they're homeless and or actively using is a little bit more challenging.
And just as a follow-up, I wonder if you are collaborating with any of the other nearby providers, be they ERs or other practices, to see if these folks may have ended up there in the interim.
Yeah, that's a good, that would probably be something that we would explore, having more formal linkages with other providers, because right now the big, when we have attempted that in the past, it's just really hard to get people on the phone, and
even emergency departments.
Right, yeah, I think that would definitely be a strategy worth exploring. We've attempted sort of more informal linkages with other organizations in the area, and It's a lot of effort that's required on both parties ends. So we haven't had a ton of luck with that, but I think that's something that we're going to have to explore more.
Another question on that issue. Lisa, that photograph you showed of I want to move there.
Yeah.
So it's a psychiatric place, so will I qualify to go there? You showed that these facilities are expanding. So I guess the increase in need is the need is the why you do that. How do you go about deciding if you need more facilities?
That's a really good question. One of the ways that we go about deciding is actually the database that we've designed can help with that a bit, because when we ask people about what type of what are the reasons for non-admission to the programs that they've called, we can see trends in types of populations that are underserved. So that's one way. It's not the main way. The main way is either that there is a business case to do so in a general way, which is to say, I don't know how to explain that so much. But there are other places that will approach McLean and ask for assistance. For example, there's a program for, I think it's policemen in the area who were looking for residential level of care. And also there's another program that has to do with And so there's sort of a, it's important for it to be highly, discreet and, specialized. So those are some of the upcoming things that we have going on.
And you came up with the data system. Who helped you develop that data system? Is there someone with your organization that does that, or did you have to kind of get a consultant to come in and come up with your data system?
Well, I developed the bulk of it. I had someone do the SQL programming, so that was someone in our IS department who had done it for the first time. He never had used that SQL as a language before, and so it was sort of the blind leading the blind.
And your title, how did that come? Would you mention your title? I had difficulty reading it because I didn't see, there wasn't a noun there.
Oh.
Those were adjectives or verbs. Process, what's your title again?
Well, there's a couple different ways to say it, so it depends on where I am, but Director of Operations Projects or Director of Operational Improvement.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. So Lisa, given what you described as the environment you came into when you started this, that things were still all happening on paper, for example, I'm imagining that you faced some resistance to change to implementing the database, the process by which the people who answer the phone handle what they're, the process they have to use. So what did you do to get from the people whose actions needed to change in order for you to have this database, and from the people above who you wanted to have use your findings?
Another good question. I spent a lot of time in person with a lot of these people and tried to sort of win them over to the idea. And failing that, I tried to work with
them. Where does it go from here?
I also, this is the same thing with the directors of the programs, and so I presented it. First I got the buy-in from the executive sponsor group, and then from there I got the buy-in from the director's level group, and then from there the people who were actually doing the work on the ground. And those folks were most important to get their buy-in, because there's not a lot of micromanagement at these programs. There's lean staff across the board. So I had to try to come up with a way to tie into what they valued, so going back to this idea of what matters to each of your customers, and I think of them as a customer. So what matters to them? Where do they find value? How can this help them in the work that they do? And also I turned to some, sort of some champions, some people who are already doing certain aspects of this well. There's one program, the one with the pretty picture, Burnside out in Princeton, Mass., where they had this philosophy of what they called operation full capacity, and they would describe that they would run to answer the phones, for example. And so it helps a lot when you have somebody who's got something working well and you can hold that up for everyone else. And it's a little bit of competition, but not exactly. They also, the group that I brought together learned, in listening to each other, that they weren't alone. They were facing the similar problems, and anytime they had ideas about how to improve it, I would incorporate that into, for example, the standard inquiry form. I changed the order to match the sort of natural conversation that you would have with someone about a program. So it was a very iterative sort of like lots of PDFAs, in particular about the standard inquiry form, where I had the most resistance.
I'm curious about, in the residential portion of McLean's services, and over the last 10 years, what percent of the patients have a substance abuse diagnosis, what percent are mental health, and what percent are dual? And have you seen the substance use increase?
I actually am not in a position to answer that. I know we have we've grown our programs that have to do with substance abuse and dual diagnosis, but I don't know the exact numbers.
Another question? Yes, ma'am.
So, Mr. Mack, did you, when you looked at the workforce data, when you're looking at access to care, are you able to terms of Hispanic doctors or African American mm-hmm. doctors. Mm-hmm. But we know with those, there's a huge difference in access to care. Would that be looked at?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the database that we have generated and that we're working on to get the rest of the response and data on, it will actually be able to pinpoint all of our minority providers to their specific location of practice, and if they have multiple, it will even assign their FTE and direct patient care at multiple sites. That is one of the strategic issues that's very, very important with data collection for workforce, just collecting that information on race and ethnicity, absolutely. Yes.
This is for Hannah. Can you say something, or what do you think the impact will be on the data about the non-responders and responders? Indiana didn't accept the Medicaid expansion. When Indiana, when you're comparing into the future, could you just say what you think the impact of that's going to be?
That they chose not to expand Medicaid?
I'm just wondering about the number of physicians. When you get the full thing, like if we could have a policy where everybody has to respond to that survey.
Absolutely.
On licensure, and then you have, maybe that's going to influence, not the demographics, but.
Well, I think, one of the things that I didn't necessarily present on today, but that is critical, is being able to link with data management, being able to link the unique Indiana Medicaid claims count to a physician license number. We can know who are our Medicaid providers, who's providing to what extent, and with these types of data, we actually can look at, are our minorities bearing the brunt of caring for our Medicaid patients versus other individuals? Who's caring for them in what locations? Now, this database, the first generation of it was 2011, but we are getting ready to re-update it in 13, and we're going to be maintaining it longitudinally. So we'll be able to look over time and see if any types of policies that we implement, whether it's in the academic side with the medical schools to try to recruit or diversify or get them engaged in community-based rotations, we'll be able to actually monitor their practice characteristics out into the future. In addition, we do have data on our providers that completed residencies in Indiana. So this presentation could have been probably an hour and a half if I had gone into all of the variables that we have in the database, but we have the ability to look at people who went through our residency programs in family medicine or the different specialties, and where are they at now? Did they come from Indiana? Did they stay in Indiana? Where are they going to? Where are they practicing? Are they Medicaid providers? Moving into the future, we'll be able to see if they worked at a community health center in their rotations, and then were they more likely to go back and work in it as a practicing provider. So those are questions we need data to be able to answer. Yes?
Nothing personal, but you're looking at access to care, mm-hmm. so you're looking at the physician claims. Mm-hmm. So how does that tell you which patient I called the doctor and I want to be seen by this doctor, and the doctor says, you haven't been approved for Medicaid, so I'm not even seeing you. So how do you capture those patients who wanted to be seen but they weren't seen? Because this is an access to care.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Who's getting into care, who's seeing these patients. So are you looking at emergency, maybe utilization?
I'll be honest, I would love to look at emergency utilization. I went to our hospital association, and then I went to the state health department, and they've been bouncing back and forth, because what we need to do now is actually look at ED utilization that comes from patients that live in the zip codes of these physicians and see who do we have going to EDs instead of offices. I think that's going to be the direction that we need to move in to actually look at demand and where we have, because now we can know the supply. But what we need to know, and what you're saying, is we need to know the demand. Where do we have unmet demand in our Medicaid populations? Where are there Indiana Medicaid recipients that don't have a provider in their geography to provide to? So, and those things, yes, I think.
If you can get the baseline, mm-hmm. they'd be interested in before affordable care, mm-hmm. utilization of their ERs and the urgent care facilities mm-hmm. versus
after
it's been implemented to just be a change.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes.
One point that stuck out from your slides was the
you know, that's a whole presentation in and of itself, right? That's tied to graduate medical education funding. Specialization. Absolutely. And so, yes, absolutely. We actually just are re-upping our state scholarship or loan repayment program, and it's going to be actually focused on primary care physicians, and I think it's actually focusing on DOs, because in Indiana we're coming online with our first DO program at a university. But so this data on the primary care workforce, we actually put out a policy brief in December of 2012. And it looked at our actual count of FTE of primary care physicians versus that which is reported by the AMA through the master file data. And they said we had 90.5 physicians per 100,000. After accounting for and having higher quality data from Indiana, we only have just over 50 primary care FTE physicians per 100,000 individuals.
How many physicians overall do you have per
100,000? Yes. I don't have that data with me, but yes, we have a lot more when you include all the specialists.
Well,
yeah, absolutely.
Also, the specialists may even exceed the
primary care. Yeah. And some of that has to do with the coding and the self-selection of your specialty or subspecialty. And that goes back to the inconsistency of data collection methods between the feds and the state and the associations. That's why we can't link these data. And the states, this should fall upon the states and the licensing agencies to collect this data, not only for the states but for the local level and for the federal level. I think the states need to take up the mantle of that.
I do have a question.
I didn't really have a question, but from Indiana, I don't really see the ratio changing a lot in the near future, just because we're a specialty. I mean, there's a new specialty hospital pretty much every other month. I mean, it seems like this brings up. So I think it's going to take some strong incentives, I would think, to switch that balance, just because, I don't know, my experience living there, there's, you can find a heart hospital, you can find a cancer hospital, you can find a hand hospital, you can find a there's, I mean, so I don't know that I see that balance changing in the near.
I agree. I think, I would hope that the changes will be hopefully driven by some of the stuff that's coming online with the Affordable Care Act. I'm hoping that the movement to accountable care organizations is going to incentivize prevention. And actually, I think this is a health systems issue, that they need to ensure the access to primary care for everyone in their service area, not only certain groups and populations within their service area.
So are you seeing more, or are you trying to appeal to more non-physician practitioners, like nurse practitioners?
Yes. Yeah.
So is that number growing?
Absolutely. And we're getting the next profession that we would like to look at is the nursing profession. So this study, we actually performed it with our dentist licensure survey and dental database, and I presented that in oral health last year. So, but yes, absolutely, with the mid-level providers for certain services and community-based settings, yes, absolutely. I think interdisciplinary teams that provide primary care, mental health care, and dental health care, I think that needs to be the future of where health care goes, especially our primary care on the ground.
You had mentioned about in your survey, well, let's start off with that. How did you conduct your survey? You said it's required,
It's elective.
Electronic, so how did people hear about it?
Well, so fortunately, this survey is actually interwoven into the licensure renewal. So when a physician or a dental hygienist, as I am, logs on to renew their license, you click, you write your name or whatever, and you find yourself and you click on it, it immediately rolls into the survey with a disclaimer that it is an elective survey, that your responses will be used for needs assessments potentially by the state of Indiana, and so there is that disclaimer. So people have to forward through the survey in order to renew their license. So it is elective, but
now it's elective.
Yes, now it's elective. But I personally think that these data are critical not only to the states, they're critical to the professions. I'm sorry?
How many questions on that?
I believe that we had 12 on the last round, but on the next licensure survey for physicians, it's going to match that which was generated by HRSA, by the National Center for Health Workforce Analysis. It will be the National Minimum Data Set tool, and we're going to dovetail with HRSA's tools so that we will be able to do comparisons interstate and everything.
Now, you also mentioned that there was a lack of response specifically, like for minority physicians. Mm-hmm. I guess because it's going to be required, this is going to be a way of increasing.
Right. How can we increase our response rate among minority physicians? You know, I think everybody wants to get information from the minority physicians because we want to know how can we get more, how can we encourage other minorities. You know, everyone wants to survey and get information from minority physicians. So I think they're inundated with surveys. And so this is maybe just another one. So how do we increase the response rate? I'll tell you one way that I believe we can increase response rate is reduce redundant questions. There is no reason if you have a database that's maintained for your state after initial licensure, why do we need to ask your race again? You're assigned your license number. That should be what we use. So any questions that are basically stable along your professional career, it's redundant and we should not continue to ask it. And things like that may actually threaten response. So if we can drop some of those demographic questions off, I think we may be able to enhance response.
Somebody else? Yeah.
This is for Monica. I'm an old social worker trained in the early 80s.
Old social worker
back when there was a big deal about, you know, you don't, the client and professional boundary, So do you get criticism about this intensive outreach? And if so, what do you say?
That's interesting. Boundaries are definitely a constant and ongoing conversation at Harlem United. When I with that triad that we have, like I said, we have several clinical directors on staff whose primary role is to work with our case management and social work staff about their relationships and the work that they do with clients. I think that first and foremost, we know that our clients have the right to refuse our services always, and so that is, that's first, and that's sort of always kept in mind when engaging clients and working with them around those issues. We don't really get criticism for that. I mean, the patient navigators are largely folks from the community, often that are also clients of ours, so we do work with a lot of our own peers, and our peers are often the people doing this work, so I think that's a really important piece of it also. There haven't been too many issues with it. I mean, when there is a criticism of it, we step back,
There is an agreement between the professional licensing agency, the PLA, and the State Health Department Primary Care Office, and I believe that there is some type of contractual payment that occurs. The data is actually extracted from the PLA database, sent to the State Health Department Primary Care Office, and then that is how we obtain it at the university to work on these projects. So the Indiana Health Workforce Database Project, in which we're trying to centralize all of the professions, we have been actively seeking funding for that. And fortunately, in the last cycle, the last budget cycle, there was, I think, some money allocated specifically to develop a health workforce center for Indiana. So we'll see how that progresses within the next year. That would put out reports, policy briefs, but also become a data warehouse that local health departments could contact? Could you give me lists of information of the providers in my community, or researchers could contact, or the state will also, of course, use, and then would maintain the database for the federal government, the minimum data set. So
this is money spent on your state?
Yes, at this time, yes.
Well, if there is no more question, we have 6 minutes. So thank you very much for coming, and.